Welcome to the podcast, One Way Or, Jewish Questions and Musings, episode number 16. I'm your host, Andrew Tertis, here with my co-host, Michael Unterberg.
How's it going? Michael? Oh, sorry, we talked over each other.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good, thank you. Really looking forward to Seder, and I know for our listeners, this is a very tight posting the recording right before Seder.
That's true. We meant to get out this episode earlier, but life ensued.
We had to pack the house, clean it up, and burn the offering and everything.
That's it. We're going to have to leave hasty as get our matzahs baked very quickly.
Yes. I'm going to first mention that one of our first recordings, which is about Sukkot, which is really about leaving the house from the known into the mystery. And in a way, we're leaving the house again, but this is our ancestral home. We're leaving slavery in Egypt. We're painting the mantle with the Paschal blood and to protect us, and then about to really go forward, step out of the out of Egypt into freedom. And it's even more than mystery. It's a real unknown that brings to it a lot of discomfort, because we're going based on a promise. It's one thing, and we're actually at some point after this, during this liberation journey, we'll be getting to those very Sukkot that we talked about. But this is a different kind of unknown. And Passover is a time where we're rehashing the story.
Well, it's true, but I think that your point about the unknown is very important, because we know that one of the themes of the night is everyone has to see themselves as if they left Egypt. Well, since none of us have reached the promised land in terms of the full fulfillment of God's promise, then we're all still on that journey that began with leaving Egypt is not yet completed. 3,000 years later, there's still, more than 3,000 years later, there's still so much history ahead of us, so much work we have to do. So,
well, I think your use of the word promise is actually a really interesting word to work with, because the Israelites were pretty much having to completely go on the faith of Moses' word as being God's word. And yes, there are these plagues that happened to the Egyptians, and things got worse and worse for the Israelites, but they really had to trust in a way that they didn't really yet trust. It was having to.
Yeah, it's funny. We read of their behavior in the Torah when the story is told. We see them complaining and fearful and doubtful. But when Jeremiah recounts what the experience was like from God's perspective in the 8th century, so that's whatever, 500-600 years after the event, God says to the Jews at the time of Jeremiah, you know, I remember our honeymoon when you guys all just walked out into the desert with me because I said I would take care of you. And that was just the best. Like, it was such a beautiful moment. Whereas in real time, we see them full of doubt. And I guess sort of honeymoons are like that in a sense. You know, they have their it's full of joy, but there's an underlying anxiety of unknown of how's this going to play out.
Yeah, there is an unknown with the Seder even. but something that we've talked about, there's actually, because many of us have been year after year reciting this story, that there's also something that's become very cemented, something stuck in a way.
Well, I think the Haggadah, and if you look at how the rabbis formulated the way they wanted this evening to happen. What does the Torah say? The Torah says, on the night of the anniversary of this event, you will tell this story to your children. And they will ask you questions and you will answer those questions. And it gives different examples. And then when you get to the rabbinic, really post-Second Temple period, there's the beginning of this sort of formalizing how this ritual will go. I think it's fair to assume that in the First and Second Temple period, we know that Passover was observed from within the text, even in biblical times, right? First Temple period, we have Passover is mentioned specifically of, for instance, the Passover of Chizkiyahu. He made a huge Passover event. So we know that it was observed. And in so doing, they would, we assume, follow the directive of the Torah to do this in question and answer format with your children. when we get to the creation of the Haggadah, we see a moment, so much of the Second Temple and its aftermath is the formalization of Jewish practice and ritual. And so Passover night becomes the same. You have this growing formalization. And that issue of the interactivity, of the question and answer format, which is so deeply built in. The halakha says that a parent has to get his child to ask him a question. And if his child isn't there, then the husband and wife should ask each other questions. And if it's a man by himself, he has to ask himself questions and answer them. And if it's a room full of learned people, they all have to ask each other questions. So this question-answer system is in the DNA of how this mitzvah is to be performed. But what happened in that formalization structure, by formalizing, these are the questions the children ask. These are the...
And these are the four sons. These are the types of questioners.
Right. Well, that's sort of a heads up to parents. Make sure you're adjusting how you do this to who's in the room. It's doing two things. The whole structure of the Haggadah is really taking biblical passage and then subjecting it to rigorous rabbinic exegesis. That sort of rabbinic style of how much can we tease out of verses? We can read the verses, but there's so much more in them, and how much can we pull out of each verse? Mm-hmm. And that's sort of Tanaitic, the sages of the post-Second Temple period, that's so stylistically theirs. That's how they tease it. And of course, I read through the entire Haggadah, but there has to be... The danger of the Haggadah is that it fossilizes that living dynamic question-answer Socratic element, which was so essential. The if you look, you know, there's so many, even in today's Haggadot, even in English, you'll see sometimes it'll say the table is removed. Did you ever see that in Haggadah?
No.
That you have to bring, because and leaning.
Well, I'm aware of the leaning.
The leaning is kind of odd, isn't it? Because what do? We kind of slump a bit in our chairs.
I read that might be from the symposia.
Absolutely what it is. That when the rabbis took this mitzvah into the idiom of their day, well, it's a bunch of people laying on their side on a pillow. The servants have little tray tables that they bring them as they sit in their symposium and hash out issues. So the structure of the Haggadah and that odd leaning that we do are vestiges of that natural give and take question answer, Jewish questions and musings, if you will, about the Exodus from Egypt. And not only does the Haggadah create, although it's meant obviously as a tool to enhance that experience, it can sometimes take the place of that experience. And I think that's dangerous.
Well, and that's... for many folks I know, including the seders I've been to and participated in during my life, that I wasn't really taught that this was a real creative time of inquiry and group inquiry as opposed to following a structure, and mm-hmm. that the structure itself was going to bring us the result.
And there's something beautiful to that structure. There's something beautiful that, you know, on that night, what, 80-90% of Jews around the world are sitting down to some variation of that structure. That's very beautiful, and it connects you thousands of years back to people using that structure.
It is beautiful, but I know you have a bone to pick with it. So,
that's the bone I have to pick with it. That you have to use it carefully and not allow it to unravel the essence of the mitzvah of the evening, which is that Socratic dynamic symposium. And we in modern times, with formalized Jewish education, with preschool and Gan and what we do with our kids now, well, how many times have you had the answer, well, why do we do this and this at the Seder? To get the kids to ask questions, right? Why do we dip? Well, the dipping symbolized that, but really, why do we do these strange things? To get the kids to ask questions. Well,
No, that's a new idea for me, is that even those strange things are to get this question
going. The rabbis hammer on that. Keep doing things at the Seder. It's quoted from the sages of the Talmudic era down. You have to do things that evening to get the kids to ask questions. And what happens as we enter into our modern 21st century world, these things have become so ritualized that they don't seem strange anymore. They just seem special to the night. So that doesn't make you ask questions. You know, we have Chol on Shabbat and a shofar. That doesn't make you ask a question. That makes you go, oh, it's Rosh Hashanah. These things become that. And then to make matters even more difficult for ourselves, in kindergarten and preschool, we send our kids to model seders. The week before Pesach, the teachers sit down and have them run through every element so that there won't be a single surprise for any kid sitting on that night. Well, what'd you just do to me?
And this is what the idea that I grew up in, which was to memorize the questions mm-hmm. and then perform them mm-hmm. during the Seder and to accolades. You know, isn't it cute?
That's cool. I'm not knocking it. I understand the purpose and the importance and even the beauty of the formalization. But you can't let the formalization take the place of the spontaneity. And we talked about this over the course of several episodes. I think it's certainly true. We talked about it in our very first episode when dealing with liturgy, that the formalization shouldn't... It has the danger of preventing the spontaneity. And you don't want one to come at the expense of the other. Here, on the night of the Seder, is the exact time when we have to have this intergenerational discussion and dialogue and dynamic and open questioning. It's so beautifully Jewish, and it's so woven into the structure of how we've seen ourselves from the founding verses in the Bible. Your children will ask you, and you will answer. Wow, is that gorgeous? It's so much about education and sharing experience rather than indoctrination, enforcement, imposition. It's so you breathe in and you breathe out question and answer and dialogue and challenge. It's so biblical, it's so Talmudic, it's so rabbinic, it's so Jewish.
Well, as we're moving towards, and we'll soon move towards some examples of revitalizing the Seder itself, I have a question mm-hmm. even before the Seder.
Mm-hmm.
With a week ago's Parsha Tzav, I was speaking with my friend Galit, mm-hmm. And she was learning the Parsha with some friends about the priests and the different offerings, including the meal mm-hmm. offering, I mm-hmm. believe, where how it's prepared, and then how the priests eat of that offering all night, and then what's left over must be burned. And there's this whole and before that, there's how the not anointing, but there's a use of the blood of the sacrificial animal that's put on the altar, the horns of the altar, and then on the priests themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then with
on their thumbs and toes and such.
Exactly. So then we start talking about how the Passover sacrifice for each family in Egypt, each mm-hmm. Israelite family in Egypt, was to there's the painting of the blood on the lintel, the doorpost,
mm-hmm.
and that this offering it was so ritualized of how it must be eaten and that it must all be eaten. That in a way, you know, there's the idea of that all Israelites, all Jews, all that will be a nation of priests.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, I'm wondering if there's a formal link to each Israelite who's about to leave slavery and having this offering versus kind of the more formalized priesthood and how they would conduct offerings, if there was intended or if this connection.
Yep.
You say more about that?
Yeah, I'll elaborate. No, I mean, look, I shouldn't say yup because I don't know what God intended, but it seems to me that it's there, right there. It's you have two different types in general of sacrifices. You have the communal sacrifices performed at the, what's the Mishkan? Tabernacle. I guess that's as confusing a word as Mishkan. And then later at the temple, you have the ones that are performed by the priests on behalf of the nation. And then you have individual ones where the individual hands something to the priest. The Passover sacrifice is a very strange one. It's the whole nation doing it. It has to be done that night. But it's individual. It's done. Individuals are doing it right. In their units.
Infinity.
Yeah, and it's not only that, but I would go a step further than even the point you're. I'm agreeing wholeheartedly and saying, it's even more than that. There's a very funny thing. It's a classic rabbinic phrase that if you miss the time, the way one of the rabbinic aphorisms for too late is bat lo zman o bat lo korbano. If you miss the korban, if you miss the time for the sacrifice, you can't do it again. And okay, so these things happen and whatever. If you didn't have time to get to Sukkot to bring or Bikurim or whatever, the only sacrifice that you can bring later is Pesach Sheni. There's a second Passover opportunity, sacrifice. And it comes up in the Bible in Bamidbar in the Book of Numbers with this request by the Jews. We were impure at the time and we couldn't participate in the Passover sacrifice
or traveling or
whatever it was. Yeah. And we, that's not fair. We went in. To which the answer should be, you were absolved. You couldn't do it, so that's fine. You know, but Moshe brings that request to God, and God says, yeah. A month later, have a makeup. And what is it? What is going on in that sacrifice? Why is it so? There's something going on where. In order to be, if you are on my staff, if you work for me, then I provide your salary, your travel expenses. Sometimes the office will provide lunches or things like that. If you're not getting that, then you have to go to HR and say there's something wrong here. Other sacrifices are religious. Activities designed to bring us closer to God. The word korban comes from closer, karov. But the paschal sacrifice, which is such a funny word, is that it's the initiation of the relationship. You work for me now. You are my staff. So everybody sit around. The group has to do it. It's done as individual units on one big team. Everybody. Sit down. And when they didn't get to do that, it's as if they missed, the office holiday party. It's as if they missed the thing that workers do to feel like they're in part of the staff. That team building, that team acknowledgement, the annual performance review. It's different. It's different than other sacrifices. So it's one of the sacrifices.
So that's why it becomes a requirement of each person, even if that particular night is unavailable.
Well, but how does it even make sense to do the Paschal sacrifice a month later? Like, is it a reenactment of that event that happened on the night of the 15th of Nisan? So it is, but it's also, there's this other part to it, that a month later you can still do your Paschal sacrifice. Because it's not about that date, it's about becoming part of the staff of God's priest team for the world.
Well, this liberation, this exodus, is a major part of the nation building of the Israelites.
It's the initiation.
So,
And I would argue that the journey ends when the mission is activated. In other words, we've never really, except for very brief moments in history, been that light unto the nations, where we stand on the stage of nations as a functional, healthy nation, that other heads of state look to us and go, oh, how do you do that? You guys are great.
Well, about Bana Devor Haberman, who I mention often in her book Blood and Ink, equates the whole process of liberation from Egypt through the receiving of Torah, Shavuot, Har Sinai, so the gestation and all the, and birth, the birth being they're actually receiving the Torah,
mm-hmm.
And it keeps going, but each stage is.
Oh, birth is a beginning. Whether you're talking about gestation or birth, you're talking about a beginning of a process. And it's a process that we're not at the end of. I don't know. I don't know how close we are to the end of it. I would wager centuries away from
actually,
the realization of the destination.
I was misremembering it. It's actually the splitting of the Red Sea. I mean, this is actually going through the canal is actually the time.
Yeah, the water breaks.
The birthing. Right. When, yeah. And us going through the canal.
Baby nation.
Baby nation.
And what does the baby nation do?
We dance.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of noise, a lot of dancing around.
So, yeah, you answered that question, and now we're back to...
I think that's fundamentally important to understand. I'm probably misremembering and misrepresenting elements of something from Rav Mordechai Breuer.
Okay, well, you can always add more details to the
it's in
resources
yeah.
page if you have it. So we come to... Each family has their way that we've done seders up till now. And we have one coming up this week. What are
and
some
a lot of
the
people
ways...
do their own. A lot of people do their own special variations. It's sort of I think of it as like the, you know, Monopoly has its rules, and then most of us do. Do you ever put like money in the middle of the board if you land in
parking?
Yeah, free parking.
Yeah,
and then do you put when you buy things? Does bank money go into that free parking fund or not? Different families have different rules, so there is already. Obviously, every family is going to have its own style, and seders morph and change based on who's in the room. So there is a lively element. I'm not, again, I don't want to sound negative. I just think I always recommend that we do more and more to bring it to life.
So basically going from homeless to homeowners, using the liberation to Monopoly players analogy. Well, you mentioned there being lots of customs. I've been looking through the A Night to Remember Haggadah by the Ben-Sion family. And one thing that Shoshana told me that they do often do before candle lighting time is they'll project the Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech, I Have a Dream speech, on the wall. And you really get into the idea of freedom even beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what are some of the ways that you and your family make to revitalize each Seder and really cause questioning?
Each Seder really becomes a challenge because if I do it this year, then it makes it difficult to do again next year because, again, they see it coming. So the trick, just like I think the rabbis are trying to tell us with the four sons, it has to be age-based. When my kids were little, I would do something really odd. The first time I did it, I forgot how old my kids were. I made myself, you know, that Egyptian headdress that kind of goes behind your ears, and I started talking like Yul Brynner at the table.
Can you give an example?
Moses and the Israelites must be free now. You know, something like that with the towel used as the headdress in my very bad Yul Brynner. Until a kid says, "What are you doing, Abba?" I think it starts with things as simple and as self-debasing as that, where it's silliness, I think, because the dipping isn't working for making them ask, why are we dipping? But something like that, I think. I one year got rid of my chair and put a recliner there and started the Seder leaning.
Uh-huh.
And it just looked weird. It doesn't take that much to get little kids to ask questions because school hasn't crushed their curiosity yet. So, you know, setting the table wrong in some way, setting things upside down. And then once you get into the, because tonight is very different, you're there. With older kids, so the first step I would say is making sure there's opportunities and encouragements to ask questions, whether that's asking them to prepare them before and go through them at the Seder, or it's just stopping at certain points and either throwing out a question and role modeling.
Yeah,
what it is
you
want to see.
Before you go too much into for the older kids,
go ahead.
I'm thinking because we're really planning for the first time to have a really engaged kids Seder. You mentioned about the kind of the being silly, and you know it's interesting because we've talked about that in the podcast where we dealt with earth-based and shamanistic Judaism, and then we had one on humor and you know, silly and. Just the idea of doing something different is a way to distract the normal way of thinking. It seems to be a theme, a recurring theme.
Mm-hmm.
One of our friends who we're having Seder with saw someone post a picture online of a Seder table, which we're going to emulate, which is blue cloth on the two long sides of the table representing the water.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the center, all these
nice
little figurines, mm-hmm. all the kids' little toys
walking
in
through
massive lines walking to the sea. So that's going to be one way.
I still want to, and I sort of did this one year where we sat around in the living room at the beginning and then only at the meal moved to the dining room table where we sort of sat around the living room. I made a little symposium. I would like to do that again and really run it that way,
mm-hmm.
where we all just laid around in a circle on our side, which is really, come on everyone, we're going to the living room and just lay around in that circle. It requires creativity, but not, I don't think, enormous creativity to make kids wonder what's going on, and that leads them to questions.
Okay, so what are some of the ways you engage older kids now, in addition to what you just mentioned?
I guess before we get to older kids, I think that silliness thing is important. There was a discussion on my Facebook feed this week. Why do we treat the plagues as something silly if they were terrible?
Right.
And should not we be educating kids to feel the sense of awe that must have bestowed instead of singing frogs here, frogs there? It was an interesting debate. It was a lively debate about... I took it off in a moral direction, saying... If you want to take the plague seriously, then you're going to have to morally question God's killing of firstborns, including infants and small children. And then you get into a question of divine morality. And that's a heavy conversation.
Right.
So that at a certain age, I think silliness is more appropriate. But I think for older kids, that conversation is important. And it could be, I think, you know, well, take place at the Seder table.
Right.
For the kids, frogs here. My mom has this thing. She loves to bring these tiny little frogs to the table and fling them at people. They just kind of squeeze them in their little froggy butts, and they fly really well. I don't think they were designed for that, but man, they just fly. So she likes to sort of it's the flicking. And then at some point, she gets adults to wear masks of different animals because of the plague of, you know, whatever era is. I think it's probably not animals, but anyway. But little finger puppets or things like that. I think as you get to slightly older kids, we do a lot of games, charades, Jeopardy.
You showed me it looked like a bingo type game.
We did bingo. And somehow once you start doing that, once the kids are old, you know, I'd say, you know, if we're talking about from preschool to lower school to middle school, those games actually work pretty well. And like so many things, they work well for adults also. And if you do something when you set up the games themselves, if you make a question that doesn't, the answer doesn't totally land right, people will ask questions during the game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, what do you mean, Miriam? Miriam found the baby. Miriam didn't find the baby. Pharaoh's daughter found the baby. So somebody has to fix the game.
Right.
If you make these fun games, you take a break, and where you put them at the Seder is really more art than science. But
so you're talking about even the art of creating flawed games, anything that will create engagement.
Yeah. Engagement's very important. It's not exactly on topic to what we're talking about question answer, but you don't get the questions if they're unengaged in the, and we try to have something, now that my kids are older, mm-hmm. and we're basically teenagers and adults, we still do something different at the Seder every year. Making Aliyah makes it much easier because there's only one. instead of two every year. But this year we're planning on
working... That was a plug from the Jewish agency.
But this year we're planning on working on like this three-tier trivia game with... It's got three elements of quiz, and then once the questions are answered, you use those questions. And then there's a charade. It's a complicated game this year as our kids are getting older and older. But that only not only creates engagement and really makes this night genuinely different as opposed to purely a review of last year. But you do it in such a way that it it does make for a question-answer discussion. There's also, it's interesting, we read in the Haggadah that it, and I referred to it earlier, we were talking about that every night, on Passover night, the person must see himself as if they left Egypt. It's interesting that the Rambam, when he formulates that mitzvah, the what we read in the Haggadah is Chayav Adam Lirot Et Atzmo Ki Ilu Hu Yatzav Mitzrayim. Every person must see themselves as if they left Egypt. Which is a great, and by the way, Sheino Yodei Lishol, the child who doesn't think to ask, is every child. There's nothing wrong with asking a child and engaging them with your question.
Right.
You know. But the Rambam doesn't say Chayav Adam Lirot Et Atzmo. He says Chayav Adam Leharot Et Atzmo. He must show himself.
To show himself as leaving
he
Egypt?
He must display himself as if Leharot... Lirot is to be is to see himself, and Laharot is to be seen as if he left Egypt. So there are certainly Sephardic traditions where they reenact things, where they lash each other with leeks to represent the, and then they'll take little bags and march around and cross over water.
Each family is going to be taking a few of the chapters from Exodus and acting them out. When it comes for our family this year, and when it comes to the Magid section, we're all going to go change, and I'm going to use some Bedouin robe, and Shoshana has a Bedouin dress, mm-hmm. And each family is going to dress the kids and all of us, and we're going to come back to the table, and each family will be acting out mm-hmm. some section. I mean, it's going to be... I'm hoping we'll be prepared, but we'll do the
well,
best we can.
Well, however you do it, you do it, and then it becomes a question of how involved do you... It's a judgment call. How involved are the kids in the drama? Or are they just watching it and generating, asking questions? We, when it came to drama parts, would usually involve the kids. Like one year, we put my son Akiva, when he was little, in a basket and put him in the bathtub. And then brought the Seder over to the bathroom, which everyone thought was pretty weird. And there it was filled with little reeds, and there was Akiva in a basket splashing along. There's really no end to the creativity. Or we, one year, we printed out pictures on the computer. And everybody looked at these. We had an Israeli soldier, the ship Exodus, matzah baking. That you look online, you can find all sorts of things that stimulate, that are either closer or further away to directly or indirectly relating to Passover, a greenhouse, and then saying, you know, pick one of these and explain, or give them out randomly or assign them.
Okay.
These are just some of the things we've done over the years, but it's really fun and worthwhile to take this time of year before the Seder and sit down and brainstorm different things you could do.
I hope that my son will ask questions, because of anyone that I know, he's experienced the whole slavery to freedom story in the time of Egypt. You know, I grew up in Connecticut, and for us it was a one-time a year thing. With him, from the time he was three, between three and four, he would call out to Shoshana and me up to the couch, and we'd have to quickly get to the couch, close the blinds, and he'd say, Choshech! And the room would be dark. That's darkness. And mm-hmm. and then the whole carpet and the whole floor all the way through the kitchen, from the living room to the kitchen, would be the sea. And then we'd jump down, and we'd run all the way across, all the way around into this one room, which was out of Choshech and across the sea. It would happen during the course of the year. So for here, you know, here mm-hmm. it's like, how do we bring that kind of spirit of living it to the Seder? When he was also about four, once about two or three in the morning, he just woke up. Ima, you know, mommy, what, Gabriel? And he had this urgency to his voice. He said, what? He said, is Paro alive? And is Pharaoh alive? And he's talking about the evil Pharaoh sure. that didn't know Joseph. And mm-hmm. And then this year, now he's six and a half, he's been asking about the angel of death, and did the angel of death kill children, and all about that. And so these are definitely his whole nature around Passover. He's lived it during the seasons. Mm-hmm.
Well, because it comes up in different contexts throughout the year. There is a biblical commandment to remember it every day. But remembering it every day isn't the same as this evening where, I mean, that's the kind of kid that you could ask him before. What do you want to do with the Seder that's going to have everyone act right. something out? Right. So again, it's varying a little from the question-answer format, but it's still creating that intergenerational dialogue. What it comes down to is that I really believe that kids do what's expected of them. And if they know that's what they're expected to do, if they're in an environment that fosters and supports, they're asking questions freely, and the adults applaud that. Not just how well did you sing Manishtana, but people give gifts to kids when they ask questions, even like a little candy.
Right.
You know, for every good question that you ask.
Right. For this one, I wrote a couple very silly rhymes using each child's name who's going to be at the Seder. So I have two for each so far. I'd like to do a couple more so that could, to make them laugh, that if they ask the question, then I'll come out with one of these little rhymes.
Mm-hmm.
And us being a...
Because they're going to want to see what your next one you have in store.
Right, right.
Right.
So
it's a challenge to get you to initiate...
Yeah, and you mentioned the puppet, finger puppets. Before anyone in my community, when I was living in California, had kids, once we had about 30 friends go up to a retreat center. We kashered the place and had this amazing Seder, and we did so much of it in puppet show, which is still a highlight for me.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else about just the... reaching that creativity and playfulness that you want to talk about, or about?
Well, one thing that I really used to do that I don't really do anymore, and this really wasn't for the night of the Seder, was I would make matzahs that we would use at the Seder. I would go over the laws. My position always was, another formalization is the fact that we rely on factory matzah now. Even handmade is industrial process. You buy it in a box. It's not a factory, so it is kind of a factory, though. It's just a hand-made matzah factory. And one of the things I tried to make clear to my kids was that the Torah, it really comes back to your point about the priests and Passover, that there are things that find that you give to the priests to do for you. But Passover, you do yourself. And you don't have to go back, when did people start buying matzahs from a factory? I don't know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago? My grandmother remembered making matzahs in her shtetl. Everybody made their own matzahs.
Well, you reminded me of something that was a beautiful experience last week. We had already cleaned our oven for Pesach, and we thought we were going to buy chalot from this wonderful baker, but he was already closed for Passover.
Mm-hmm.
So we made... pitot outside, and the fire that I, the wood that I used to make the fire was from the schach, the roof covering of the sukkah, and it just felt great
right.
to have that cycle. And of course, we'll be burning all the rest of our chametz Friday morning, and we still and then we have this whole little pile of the remaining schach to do that.
There's an old European tradition of taking the lulav from Sukkot and putting it in the shul on the Aron,
and then bringing those lulavim now that they're dried for Passover and burning chametz using.
Right, so it's that idea.
Right,
it's and that to idea. See Gavriel actually help me clean out, you know, carry over these palm branches and other eucalyptus we had. That reminds me of something else. I was reading in the Haggadah about teaching by the seer of Lublin, the Jose, who lived about 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And he looked at the priestly blessing, the Yivrechecha, Hashem Vishmerecha, that he looked, which is usually translated as may God bless you and guard you or protect you, that he looked at the Yishmerecha, the Shin Mem Resh, the Shmer, as the sharing the root of Shmerim, of yeast.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it's translated is like yeast in your soul, causing you to ferment and mature, to rise and elevate to your highest possibilities, to reach your highest self. And then I thought about how here we are, we're cleaning the houses, and cleaning them from chometz and yeast, everything that really would arise. And looking at it this way, it's if we clean the external rising agents, then the true essence can rise inside, our yearning for God, our yearning for freedom, and all that.
Well, there is that. There's always that tension about what are we taking in from the outside and what is coming from within. You know that that bread and beer, probably beer earlier than bread, or some of the earliest, go very, very early in human civilization. Before there were cities, there was bread and beer. But risen bread, as opposed to flatbread, comes relatively recently. It was developed by the Egyptians. So that to a certain extent, that removal of risen bread, of going back to flatbread, is saying we're on our own now. We're leaving even the technological innovations of the great empires behind as we forge our own path. There's something in there about that, I think.
Okay, sure. And also going back to what we were talking about with the offerings, the priests with the offerings, they were offering flatbreads.
Mm-hmm.
So
almost exclusively, yeah.
So they weren't calling that flatbread loaves of affliction or poverty. They were
no,
these
yeah,
were
that,
the sacred breads to offer.
There's that funny thing that certain symbols at the Seder serve dual purposes, so that matzah is both affliction, but it's also that we were able to escape so quickly is a sign of freedom. So you have certain things. It's a little bit like what does water symbolize? Well, if I say the blood flows like water, then it means it's something very cheap. If I say it's a necessity to me like water or air, now I'm talking about something deep, you know, a necessity that you can't go without. So it's very valuable. So symbols often work in these sort of complex, multifaceted ways.
Yeah. I think there's just one other way of looking at Pesach that is curious to me. I'm wondering what you say about it, that I was reading something from Arya ben David, that Pesach, the mouth, Pei, that talks. And his recommendation was to, for kids, is to, or with kids, is to point at each thing on the table, on the Seder plate, and during the course of the evening, and ask, well, what would that say? You know, mm-hmm. What would the matzah say mm-hmm. to us? What, you know, another way of getting that interaction going.
It's infinite, and what's beautiful about it is that it becomes personal. It becomes an expression of those parents and those kids or those grandparents or that uncle and aunt. That somehow how you bridge that gap defines both of you in a way that's both personal but both part of this enormous story that you're part of, you're part of the Jewish people who've been doing this for so long in so many ways and always the same way. That's just an astonishing journey. Every person can really see themselves as if they left Egypt, because we've left and we're still on this wild process.
Yeah, there was one year where Shoshan and I actually went to Sinai, the Egyptian Sinai desert, right before Passover.
Cool.
And it was this amazing, you know, we took the Egged bus, which is it's almost faster to walk.
Yeah.
You know, this experience of leaving and coming to the Seder was a powerful experience.
You did that before, and then you came back to, what did you do? You came back to Israel for the Seder?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, everyone do that. That's cool. Be like Andrew. Go to Egypt.
Although you know, people back then said that was dangerous. That was almost 10 years ago.
All right. Now so a little Arab Spring here or there. It's spring cleaning. It's part of the fun.
I think we're getting ready to wrap up. Is there any other ideas or teachings you want to bring?
Yeah, I guess the only thing I would add is you have to be a little bit careful of the usually adult tendency to say, when do we get to the food? And there's something to that, because the meal is obviously a joyous part of the evening. But it's worth probably, however you can do this in an appropriate diplomatic way, to say, we're not trying to rush through the part before the food. We're trying to turn it into this dynamic question-answer period, and we'll get to the food.
Well, for someone who food is a major orientation in his Jewish life, I will take that to heart. I've been really enjoying all this preparation this year and look forward to the journey.
Yeah.
Thank you all for listening to our podcast, One Way Or, Jewish Questions and Musings, our episode number 16. I'm your host, Andrew Tertis, getting ready for Seder, here with my co-host, Michael Unterberg.
Chag Kasher V'Sameach, everybody.
And go ahead.
Just happy, joyous Passover.
Yes, and our music is brought to you by Jewish blues pioneer, Saul Kay.
Bye.
Bye.